You are listening to the Space Show on Southern FM with Andrew Rennie. Last night, the Space Industry Forum was held, and it discussed the new satellite utilization policy. That's a policy we've discussed many times here on the Space Show. Michael Davis from the Space Industry Forum, he lives in Adelaide, kicked off the proceedings. Here's how it went.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Space Industry Forum. My name is Michael Davis. I'm Chair of the Space Industry Association of Australia, and it's great to see you all. The response to our advertisement has been very, very encouraging, and today we are discussing a topic of very immediate interest and importance to the Australian space community, and that is the implementation of the new National Satellite Utilisation Policy. Before we start, I should ask everyone to turn off your mobile phones, and also to tell you that the audience for this forum is not just the people sitting here in Collins Street, but also the audience of Andrew Rennie's space show and on the Southern FM radio station. And if any of you are interested in consulting the archives of all the space events that have been recorded, especially in Victoria, you should go to Andrew Rennie's website, Southern FM. If you search on Southern FM space show, you'll see a wonderful historical archive of audio presentations from various space events. The Space Industry Association of Australia is a very active national industry representative body. We've been around for 20 years, and we're expanding our reach and increasing our level of activity, and we intend to hold a series of space industry forums such as this each year, and we chose Melbourne as the site of our first forum for 2013 because we know that there is a considerable amount of space-related activity, research and commercial development in Melbourne and Victoria. So it's wonderful to see you all here. And also, I'd like to acknowledge the fact that some of you have travelled from other places, from Adelaide, Canberra, Sydney, so it's great to see you all. We will have three speakers. Our first speaker will talk about talk from the perspective of the Australian government and the Australian Space Policy Unit, soon to be renamed, and we'll hear exactly what the government is saying about the new satellite utilisation policy. Our second and third speakers will speak to you from the perspective of the satellite industry, and they'll be telling you how they use satellites and how they see the impact of this new policy on what they do.
Now, Michael then moved on to introduce the next speaker.
Our first speaker is Jennifer Doyle, the manager of the Space Policy Unit of the department whose name I cannot possibly memorise. But it used to be the acronym used to be DESERT. That was easy to remember. But with climate change added, it's impossible to convert into an acronym. You know what department it is. Jennifer was originally in academia and had made a second career as a space bureaucrat, and she'll tell you all of the fascinating things about what she is doing, and in particular she'll introduce us to all the changes that will be brought about as a result of the government's adoption of the new satellite utilisation policy. So please welcome Jennifer.
Thank you, Michael. I mean, I know I only have 15 minutes or thereabouts, so it'll be hard to cover absolutely everything about the policy, but I'll just give you a broad overview of the key, underlining priorities from a government perspective. So, thank you for the opportunity to speak at this forum. My presentation today will provide a brief overview of the new National Space Policy, Australia's Satellite Utilisation Policy, the work of the new Space Coordination Office, and the importance of enhancing our engagement with stakeholders to progress the policy. The overarching goal of Australia's satellite utilisation policy is to assure ongoing, cost-effective access to the satellite capabilities on which we rely, namely through Earth observations from space, position navigation and timing, and satellite communications. These capabilities are principally via satellites and satellite-related infrastructure, hence the title of the policy. This civilian space policy is realistic and practical, with a focus on the space information Australia needs for its socio-economic and environmental well-being over the short to medium term. The seven principles listed form the basis of an achievable and realistic strategy which builds on Australia's competitive strengths, the effective accessing, interpretation and use of space-derived data, and the provision of the necessary ground infrastructure to achieve this. The latter is being addressed through the two infrastructure plans related to the policy, one on Earth observations, the other on positioning. These plans are currently being finalised through the appropriate government agencies, Geoscience Australia and the Bureau of Meteorology. From a government perspective, working with key Australian government stakeholders such as Geoscience Australia, CSIRO and the Bureau of Meteorology is essential to progressing most of the principles under the policy. For those who have not read the policy, I encourage you to do so. I'm sure you will agree that it is a sensible and explicit strategy that is specific to Australia's needs, yet enhances our standing in the international space community. Currently, there are 90-odd Australian government programs that utilise and or depend on information derived from space. Therefore, a key role of the new Space Coordination Office is to help ensure that these programs can continue to access this information. In terms of resourcing, the office will maintain a staffing level of 5 officers, including the manager, and will be funded within the existing resources of the department. It should be stressed that the office is not set up to provide technical expertise. Across government, technical expertise is maintained by a number of organisations where this expertise is relevant to their operations, such as Geoscience Australia, the CSIRO, Bureau of Meteorology. It is up to our office to coordinate this expertise. For example, an international space agency may approach the Space Coordination Office in its capacity as the first point of contact for Australian government space activities regarding a bilateral meeting. We will ascertain the topics they wish to discuss and organise the appropriate technical expertise from government and or industry to participate at this meeting. Overall, the office will be and can be seen as a continuum of communication and engagement with both government, international and domestic stakeholder groups involved in providing a whole of government narrative on Australia's space activities. The new office will also manage the secretariat for the new Australian Government Space Coordination Committee, the SCC. This will be an interdepartmental government committee. The SCC will be responsible for information sharing across organisations on Australian government's civilian space activities, including the prioritisation of these activities. Ultimately, the SCC will feed its deliberations to the Minister and inform government priority setting. The office will also be the secretariat for the new advisory committee. This committee will comprise of representatives from state and territory governments, industry and research, and will be a key mechanism for the provision of advice to government from the space sector. Other areas under the governance arrangements will be the responsibility of the appropriate agency. For example, Geoscience Australia will manage the Earth Observations from Space Working Group and the Position, Navigation and Timing Working Group, which will feed into the Space Coordination Committee. The office will maintain the administration of the Space Licensing and Safety Office, referred to as SLASO. SLASO implements the regulatory and safety regime for space activities in Australia and by Australians overseas. The office has responsibility for enforcing the provisions of the Space Activities Act 1998 and the Space Activities Regulations 2001, as well as any other agreements entered into by the Australian government for space launch activities. It assesses applications for approval under the Act and has responsibility for the ongoing development of subsidiary regulations and guidance material. This ensures that space activities do not jeopardise public safety, property, the environment, Australia's national security, foreign policy or international obligations. Since the establishment of SLASO in June 2001, a number of space activities have been approved. Two high-shot launches at Woomera, the FedSat microsatellite, the Optus C1 and three Optus D series satellites. The new office will continue to actively engage internationally to advance Australia's interests on space-related issues and advocate the benefits derived from space capabilities. We will continue to be involved in multilateral space-related forums, including current co-chair responsibilities for the Regulation and Law Group within the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. The officer responsible for this will be attending this particular forum next month. We will continue to be involved in key regional forums, such as the Asia-Pacific Regional Space Agency Forum, APRSAF. We are currently leading the Climate Regional Readiness Review initiative within this forum, which focuses on the use of space-derived data for climate policy. We are also actively engaged in bilateral arrangements, developing and managing treaties, agreements and MOUs with other countries to assist the development of space-related links and high-level collaborations. Now a word on the Australian Space Research Program. This program, which provided $40 million of funding to 14 projects, will conclude on 30 June 2003, and there is no program at this stage to follow it. However, the level of collaboration through the ASRP projects is impressive. This high level of collaboration was something hoped for in the planning of the program. Also encouraging is the emergence of spin-off activities from the projects, which was highlighted at the ASRP showcase event on 9 April in Canberra. This demonstrated a future for many of these projects beyond the ASRP program. And finally, a word on stakeholder engagement. Effective stakeholder engagement will be crucial to the work of the new Space Coordination Office. This engagement will be with Australian government agencies, international partners, industry and research, and will need to be targeted and relevant to the objectives of the policy. In terms of our industry stakeholders, the Space Coordination Office plans to organise an annual forum which will provide an opportunity to update the industry sector on key government space activities and priority areas. That's all I have to say very briefly, but I am very open to any questions from the audience during the panel session. Once again, thank you for inviting me to present at this forum. I look forward to working with you as key stakeholders as we progress activities under the new satellite utilisation policy. Thank you.
That was Jennifer Doyle, the manager of the Space Policy Unit in Canberra, with an introduction previously by Michael Davis. She was speaking yesterday afternoon in Melbourne at a meeting of the Space Industry Forum. And we must correct a slip of the tongue there. I think she said 2003 was when the funding would end for that space activities thing they've got going. I think she meant 2013. So 2013, not 2003. And we must apologise for the scraping noise there. Entirely our fault. We put our microphone in the wrong place, and it turned out to be rather noisy. We have more from this forum after these messages.
On the corner of Nepean Highway and Brewer Road, Classic Residences Brighton offers independent and assisted living options that have set the benchmark for retirement living. Several new over 55s apartments have recently been constructed and refurbished, featuring generous bedrooms, open plan living, fully equipped kitchen and much more. These apartments at Classic Residences Brighton are selling fast. So for more information, contact Tracy on 9599 2300, 9599 2300.
Southern FM sponsor.
This is Southern FM 88.3.
Well, you're listening to The Space Show, and we are in Melbourne yesterday afternoon at a space industry forum, and a number of speakers, three speakers this evening, and the next two speakers will be talking about how space is used by Australians. John LaMarshall is the regional program leader at the Bureau of Meteorology in Melbourne, and he was outlining, first of all, a few things about his career and what he was doing, and unfortunately we were refreshing our recording and we missed the first few words of what he had to say, but the rest was absolutely fascinating. You wouldn't believe some of the instruments that are now available for measuring the weather.
Space Science and Engineering Centre at Wisconsin for considerable periods, CNES in France, and recently I was director of the NASA NOAA and Department of Defence Joint Centre for Satellite Data Assimilation in Washington, and they were responsible for bringing all the new generation satellites online and setting them up to run and be ready to be used by the Weather Service, the Department of Defence, NASA and so on. So we basically saw all the new generation instrumentation into operations and took part in designing some of the systems. So what I'm going to do today is I've just taken this document here and I'm going to talk about it in relation to what goes on in the Bureau of Meteorology. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the Australian Government satellite utilisation policy, and I've just gone through this document and listed the elements, strengthening Australia's use of space, and I think this is germane to the Bureau's activity. 99.9% of our observations come from space, and as you'll see, they really determine the quality of our weather prediction and warning service. Why should Australia be involved in space? Well, in relation to the Bureau, we just can't do business without it. So strengthening our use of space and being involved is just most important to what we do. And these are the list of Australia's national goal in space. And it says here Australia wishes to achieve the following. Well, nearly all these things: improved productivity, better environmental management, a safer and secure Australia. All these things actually pertain to the activities. You can go through each of these and see how the Bureau contributes to this. Obviously, we result in improved productivity, say by improving aviation forecasts, agricultural forecasts, allow better environmental management through our measurements. We provide a safe and secure Australia because we warn where tropical cyclones are coming. You can go through a myriad of applications that we do. A smarter workforce, a lot of the supercomputing initially was people were trained in the Bureau, and the activities we do in terms of, say, now solar radiation is becoming very important. A lot of that initial work will be done in the Bureau because you both measure it from space and you also predict it with a forecast model. So there's new industries and new activities all the time. And what I'm going to do is just step through how this document says we're going to achieve our space goal, and I'm going to go through each of the principles and just say a few words about each of them in relation to the Bureau's activity. First one is focus on space applications of national significance. Now, the ones listed here are Earth observations, satellite communications, and position, navigation and timing. And it's interesting, with especially in the forecast field, we use Earth observations from space. In fact, we use the communication or the GPS satellites, the position and navigation and timing satellites, to measure temperature for us, which is not well known. And we also use communications to do our business. So on principle one, I'm going to talk about first Earth observations from space and the considerable impact they have in the Southern Hemisphere. And I think this will surprise you. If you look in the Southern Hemisphere and look at the impact of satellite data, you'll find that their impact's huge. And what we've done here is take an experiment where we've run our forecast with all the satellite data and non-satellite data together. We've run our forecast system with just our non-satellite data. And we've run it with the Bureau's operational model, ACCESS. And just so you don't believe us alone, we've also run the forecast with the forecast model from the USA, the NSEP model. So these are two operational models from two parts of the world, slightly different databases, and have been run with and without satellite data. Now, to give you a feeling for what goes on in an operational shop, we take data from approximately 30 to 40 satellite instruments every 6 hours. We cross-calibrate all the infrared instruments, the microwave instruments. We take the bending angle of GPS signals coming through the atmosphere, because they're dependent on refractivity and temperature, and we can get temperature profiles out of those. And that was an ASRP research project that got that one started, so using GPS in this system. That also allows us to measure climate out over the oceans. We take clouds and we track every cloud on the map here and every bit of water vapour, and we produce winds through the atmosphere as well. So we go through this and we actually have to use 30 instruments, and probably in an operational shop we use 100,000 million observations a day. Because as well as using those instruments I talked to you about, there are other instruments that measure the spectrum in 8,000 or 3,000 channels. And each one of those measurements you view as an observation. And they all feed into the system. The advanced sounders that measure thousands of channels can measure temperature to a degree from the surface to the top of the atmosphere. So we can specify the atmosphere pretty well. Now, we put all these into our global forecast model, and these are just a list of the other data that's in there, mainly satellite data, but there's ship data, buoy data, aircraft data, and all these instruments is like acronym soup. I'm not going to go through it, but there's a large number of them. Our global model's about 47 kilometres, and what we find, if we run our global model and we measure something called the height at which the pressure reduces to 500 hectopascal, you get a map that looks a bit like a mean sea level pressure map with different numbers on it. And this is usually an indication of the skill of the forecast. How well you can forecast this field gives you an idea of how good the forecast model is. So what I've got here is these curves here, which are the decay curves showing how the forecast that's done with no satellite data decays with time. And this 0.9 is a correlation between the forecast and the verifying analysis. So you start off quite good with no satellite data after 24 hours. You're looking good. But very soon, you're pretty shabby. The forecast's not that flash. And what happens is, if you look at, say, 0.9, you find if you start the system with satellite data in, it degrades, but it takes 4 days. At 4 days, the quality of a forecast with satellite data in is equal to the quality of a forecast without satellite data. So our forecast system without satellite data will be reasonably average. So that's run with our ACCESS model. Now, this is verified against the analysis with all the data in. And I'm not going to go into details of verification. But this is the one I just showed you. The quality of a forecast at 24 hours with no satellite data is equal to the quality of a forecast at 4 days with it. This is the US system. Same thing. 24 hours, the average is about 0.9 here. Without satellite data, 4 days, it's 0.9 again. So you get exactly the same gain running the US model over the Southern Hemisphere. Big gain from satellite data. Now just to show you the nature of reality, these are the forecast curves for the Northern Hemisphere, for the people who pay for the satellites. They get half day or a bit more improvement in forecast through the satellite system. So this is something that I think people should bear in mind. These people are paying a lot of money for what they believe is an economic benefit, yet their impact's a fraction of that in the Southern Hemisphere. So I won't say any more than that. I think that's easy to work out for yourself. The other thing is, so I've shown you anomaly correlations and it's amazing that the forecast skill is one day without satellite data, 4 days with it, have the same skill. The interesting thing is, what does this mean? Well, you take the access forecast for, say, heavy rain on the 9th of October. If you run with satellite data, you get heavy flooding rains in Victoria. Without satellite data, you've missed out. And this is a verifying analysis. Now, this, you might say, this is only one case, but the reason, I'll show you what the average for the month, but this is no fluke. And the interesting thing is that the message from this is, what does it mean? Well, an emergency manager needs 2 days' notice or 3 days' notice to get his truck out in the sandbags and prepare. You can't do that without a good long-range forecast, and you don't get a good long-range forecast without Earth observations from space. So when people ask you what are the economic benefits, you say, well, you're enjoying them all the time. When you see people, you know, sandbagging for floods or whatever, you're already enjoying the benefits. And if you look at the correlation between observed and forecast rain, you find it's 0.282, almost nothing with no satellite data, out of 2 to 3 days, 699 with it. So there's a considerable benefit. This, you say, okay, this was the 9th of November. What happens if you do a month? Well, you do a month, you still see a considerable improvement. I mean, this is averaging over a month, and it's, you know, speaks for itself. The other thing is tropical cyclones. Now, instead of doing this in Australia where it's duck soup, because out over the oceans there's very few planes, very few ships, I did this in the Atlantic with the US run. So this shows you here, you've got the blue lines of truth. This is the start of the tropical cyclone Earl's track. 24 hours, 48 hours. When you run with satellite data, you get the red track, almost on top. Run without it, you get the green track. So the errors are quite big. That's in an area with plenty of aircraft, plenty of ships, more observations we get in the Southern Ocean. So this just shows you another model, similar result. And if you look over a whole season, not just one case, you see 36 hours, 2 days, the forecast track errors are doubled without satellite data. That's in an area where we've got plenty of obs. So what I'm saying, I guess the message is, Earth observations from space have a considerable impact on our way of life now. I mean, our forecast of prediction tracks for tropical cyclones are probably depend on this data, as well as rainfall and other important things. So that's principle one. Principle two, assure access to space capability. And I guess the things the Bureau does to assure access, we participate in the planning of EOS. We CalVal EOS data for other people. We participate in the collection and distribution of this data. We collect data from the satellites and retransmit to other parts of their globe for their global model. And hopefully in the future, when the Cosmic Constellation, which is a group of satellites that measure radio occultation as a bending of GPS signals, we'll probably end up putting I've got this gravy because it hasn't been signed off, but we'll probably put a reception station for the Cosmic Constellation in Northern Australia. And if we were very brave, we could actually put two cosmic receivers that cost about $300,000 each onto two satellites like FedSat, we've already practiced once, put them into space and become a full partner. And the reason I say that is because visibility for us in this game, I think, is important because we're so dependent on the activity. Okay, we also, in Australia, process winds from observations from space and distribute those, and we process atmospheric moisture, and we've developed, you know, focal plane arrays for ATSR, AATSR, and I should put a whole lot of dots here, I haven't got time, but the Bureau's been involved with, you know, this being part of the team assures our access, helps assure our access to space data. Principle three, strengthen and increase international cooperation. Well, I guess the Bureau's heavily involved through WMO, and we've got an ex-president of WMO in the room now, and we're also involved in the Asia-Pacific Satellite Data Utilisation Forum, and through a whole lot of satellite-related activities that actually strengthen our international cooperation. In fact, people from Australia are involved in the technical panels of NOAA, you know, helping to produce the next generation of operational satellites. So Australia has a fairly strong involvement overseas. We contribute to a stable space environment, and that's through WMO and all those things. We improved domestic coordination. I guess the Bureau has been involved in the planning of ground station facilities because we have a large number of ground stations, and I'm not going to go through the acronym, but this was written up in for and provided as a starting point for the foundation of the Australian ground station system. We participate in the distribution of EOS data. We've developed a very capable scientific processing capability, and we've developed coordinated processing capacity around the whole country. And this involves not just us, it involves the universities, CSIRO and others, where we've collaborated to produce a strong system that can be used by all. And where impossible, we've been involved in this. We've put in applications. We've been involved with VIPAC in, the GGM and so on. And I don't know whether that'll ever go anywhere, but if it does, that's the sort of instrument that we'll have to deploy for environmental intelligence to be able to measure CO2 in the atmosphere and so on. Number six is support innovation, science and skills development. And I guess we've been involved with the ASRP and lots of activities in terms of developing the science and developing the operational processing of EOS data. We've worked out new techniques for, in fact, it was an Australian who first worked out how to get big impact from the advanced sounders, which are probably the most significant instrument in the sky. We've done a lot of work in developing EOS-related skills, supported postgrads, postdocs, and done a lot of training. And we've been involved with a lot of people, so in actually supporting innovation, science, and providing skills development. And clearly, we support the Defence Department. We look at the change of climate, which is important for the country's long-term well-being. We support agriculture, have specialised forecast and warning systems. So most of them are just reasonably straightforward. In terms of Australian government responsibilities, where does the Bureau appear? In the document I showed you, we appear under one of the partners in Earth Observations from Space. The Bureau is named there, and also for space weather. Like NSEP in the USA, meteorology and space weather have been combined together. And I think it's probably a good idea because the instruments for this, say, for instance, on the US satellites, weather satellites, all the space weather instruments are on the same satellite. And when you go through the review process, which I've been involved in, you actually have to review those instruments and also make sure that the package is going into space and healthy. So that's that's the way things are, and it's probably a sensible thing. The coordination framework you've told us all about before, so we all know about that. And I think I was asked when I came here, what impact will this policy have on our projects and plans? Well, I'm really happy to say it sort of reinforces our current approach. I think what's written down in this policy is really common sense, we thought. It's good, but I guess the detail is a bit to get you. What opportunities does it open up? Well, I think that clearly indicates support for space applications of national significance, and I think an effort that will focus on space applications of significant security, economic, social and impact, okay, specifically the Earth observation, these three. And I think the Bureau's activity clearly falls within this very strongly, and I think the Bureau's probably, in terms of having support, you would think from reading this document, we'll have a significant amount of support for our activity. And given what I showed you about the importance of Earth observation from space, it's almost a common sense approach. What initiatives do you advocate for government, private industry and the research sector? Well, I think the obvious answer is a balanced investment in infrastructure, research and people. I think we need to do this. I think if we don't do this, our access to space may not be as free as we think it is. When I was director of the Joint Centre in Washington, I went to meetings with NASA, NOAA and the DOD in our very high-level meetings. And I can tell you here that the Australian Academy of Science in this strategy plan talked about Australia being viewed as a free rider. And that, in fact, you go to these meetings and that, in fact, is true, particularly when the US and European economy went down and ours didn't. This was this was mentioned openly. So I think we've got to be visibly seen to have a balanced investment in infrastructure, research and people, and actually be seen to be a partner of the community. This is not a sales job. I'm just telling you how it appeared to me. It was reasonably straightforward. I guess the other part of the summary is Just in a little bit, I went off talking about EOS. Analysis and prediction using current and future satellite systems have been examined. We've noticed the great benefits. There's huge benefits still to come. We're only just scratching the... and this isn't a sales pitch. We're only using a small fraction of the data that's coming down, 5 or 10%. There'll be significant improvements. The economic benefits will be significant. And what's more... billions are still being put into future instruments at the moment and future space activity. And I think, as I said, we need careful investment in infrastructure, research and trained staff to make sure we can take benefits that that offers. And my last thought is, talking about space business, looking down is looking up. And I'll stop there.
That was John LaMarshall, the regional program leader of the Bureau of Meteorology right here in Melbourne. We'll return to the forum in a moment.
Set within lush open and parklands, Sandy Hill Apartments Sandringham are offering the opportunity to secure one of the most luxurious apartments currently under construction. These modern and elegant apartments, designed by leading Melbourne architect Fender Katsalidis, are located next to the Bay Road Heathland Sanctuary, offering you spectacular views of Port Phillip Bay, the city skyline and the Dandenongs. Set within a resort-style garden setting, Sandy Hill Apartments Sandringham offers you large, open-style living located close to Melbourne beaches, world-renowned golf courses, chic cafes and stylish fashion boutiques. Stage 1 is currently under construction and selling quickly. To secure a new Bayside lifestyle, call Sandy Hill Apartments Sandringham on 95970422 to arrange an appointment today. Sandy Hill Apartments Sandringham is a proud sponsor of 88.3 Southern FM.
Leading Dramatic Society Theatre has already presented a number of interesting productions this year and has more scheduled. If you want news and information about LDST, or if you want to join it, then please go to its webpage, www.simplesite.com/relax-and-connect. That's www.simplesite.com/relax-and-connect. Leading Dramatic Society Theatre, a proud sponsor of 88.3 Southern FM.
On this evening's The Space Show, we are at a space industry forum, which was held yesterday afternoon, going on to yesterday evening in Melbourne, organised by the Space Industry Association of Australia. The next speaker was Peter Woodgate, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Cooperative Research Centre for Spatial Information. And we'll just go right back to the forum now.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Let me just set the scene for the CRC for you. We've been in existence for 10 years now. We've got 94 organisations who are partners, 55 companies, 20 government agencies and 20 universities and research institutes. And in recent years, New Zealand has joined us as a major partner. So with Australia and New Zealand, Cooperative Research Centre for Spatial Information. Our industry and our science community are very pleased that we've now got a satellite utilisation policy, building on the back of a space policy for industry of a couple of years ago. And I'm just showing here the launch that sort of ensured that we had a high-profile development of the policy itself, and we were delighted to be there. Now, Jennifer's adequately covered the policy in terms of its principles. I just want to emphasise that two of the three major themes in the policy are spatially related. They're spatial science: position, navigation and timing, and Earth observation. Over the last couple of years, Australia's put a big effort into developing strategy around national positioning and Earth observation. And I'm going to talk about both of those in a moment. These are coming to fruition, though, in terms of plans which are being put to the Australian government. In the first case, the National Positioning Infrastructure Plan was initiated by Cabinet. The plan has now been worked through in 2012 and has gone through all the states and a lot of stakeholders and is now coming back. The Earth Observation from Space plan and strategy has been developed by the stakeholders, with Geoscience Australia playing a lead role. And Just to remind us, on the right-hand side are the priority areas for the space policy. I won't go back over these now. You've seen them both in Jennifer's talk and in John's talk. But let's bear those in mind as we go through what I'm about to tell you about the activities that we're involved in. In relation to the national positioning infrastructure, this policy and plan is going to tick off every one of those activities on the right-hand side, and it's going to do a lot more for us. It's going to set an overarching picture for infrastructure investments in precise positioning for Australia. Its overall objective is to be able to give us the ability to position ourselves in real time, with no latency, to within 2 centimetres of true, anywhere, outdoors, at any time. In addition to that, the strategy acknowledges the need to have seamless integration between outdoor positioning and indoor positioning. So as you can see on the diagram here, we are taking into account not just the outdoor continuous operating reference stations that are building a network of precise positioning solutions across Australia using satellite positioning from the Global Navigation Satellite Systems suite, but also a range of other indoor and local positioning systems. And ultimately, we're going to have an integrated approach. Now, that's a really significant objective for Australia, the fact that the disparate approaches we've been taking at the moment, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, are now coming together in an agreed overarching strategy. If we can achieve this, our economic modelling undertaken by Allen Consulting tells us that we will add $32 billion of gross value to the Australian economy through a single network solution positioned to within 2 centimetres. And that modelling has been done to Treasury rigour. So at stake is a very significant value add for Australia. How do we get there, though? Now, there's a few minor issues that we have to tackle. Most of us are probably aware that there are now 5 additional systems to GPS being developed. Some are global and some are regional. So Russia, the European Union with Galileo, Russia with GLONASS, the Japanese, the Indians and the Chinese are all developing GNSS or regional navigation satellite systems. And I'm told just recently that Korea are going to develop a regional navigation satellite system as well. Has anybody heard that?
North or south?
I'll leave you to determine which one that is. So we get another flag to that list. And if you look at the bottom left-hand corner, you can see a kind of a heat diagram. And I apologise for those of you sitting at the back of the room. At the top is the number 60, which gives us an idea of the number of satellites at any one time that any location within the Earth is going to be able to see. That's the red. Round here in the middle is the yellow. We've got about 50 to 40, and then down the bottom is the blue, and you've got less than 40. See where the concentration is here? It's around the west of Australia and up through Central Asia here. But Australia is one of the few countries in the world that enjoys almost peak coverage for most of the time. I'm led to believe that we can thank Andrew Dempster for this diagram. Andrew originated that diagram and we use it extensively. It gives us a pictorial case for allowing those who don't fully understand the power of positioning to understand why we would want to develop the capability of ingesting the signals of all of those systems at once to be able to feed into our precise positioning objective. So, there's a little research that's required first before we can read all of those signals seamlessly through our continuous operating reference system. And in the CRC, one of our 8 research programs, the positioning program, is designed to solve the problems, to bring those signals together, to provide that precise solution. And you can see around the arrows there, the individual components in our research program which are going to be designed to solve that problem. So we've got research teams from The University of Melbourne, the University of New South Wales, Curtin University, Queensland University of Technology, RMIT University, right across Australia, actively involved in this. We've got the Australian New Zealand Land Information Council, peak body for all of the government agencies sitting behind this, and a large number of our companies are actively involved as well. So a significant national effort going into solving the research problems here. Recently, we have developed the capability to bring together Galileo and GPS in a single solution, GPS and Beidou, which is the Chinese system, and GPS, Beidou and Galileo. So our research teams are already making significant advances here, and these advances will be capable of being used globally. So, just to go into a little bit more detail, what we're looking to do is to develop a real-time kinematic precise point positioning solution. So that means precise down to 2 centimetres or below, real-time and kinematic on the move. So wherever you are, developing that solution. And here we're showing our ability to go from about 1 metre positioning accuracy down to, well, maybe even 1 centimetre. We're setting ourselves the objective of 2, but maybe even lower than that. And our tests are beginning to show that we're capable of achieving that. So the research in this program, although it's only a couple of years old, is making significant progress already. Now, here I've got a slide which one of our PhD candidates has developed, Grant Hausler, and Grant is in the audience today. Grant is telling us in this slide that we've only got 8% of Australia covered at the moment by networks that offer the 2 centimetre solution. And I say networks because there are 6 different networks in this one, Grant, or is it more?
Yeah, I think it's 6.
So we don't have a single solution. So if you're going to drive around Australia, you've got to hook into each of these different networks. And that's not an easy thing to do. What we're looking to do is to develop a single network, like a single copper wire for Telstra. And that requires a political solution, agreement from the agencies, as well as the technical solutions. So we're working on the technical solutions. This diagram gives us our 8% coverage for the network solution, but also shows the density of the base stations across Australia, which will enable us to build that network. We're going to need to look at densities like that in Victoria, which can already achieve a 2 centimetre positioning solution. The rest of Australia can't get there yet. There are parts that can, but most of Australia, the vast majority of Australia, can't. And what we're looking to do is to enable that network to be densified, perhaps not to the same level as Victoria. If we can do it without going to 70 kilometres spacing for the base stations, maybe we can go further out, but still get that 2 centimetres. We can save the investment in the infrastructure and improve our efficiencies. So why is that significant? Well, let's look at Japan here. And here we have the whole of Japan, and we're showing the network of continuous operating reference stations all linked in Japan right across the nation. You can see the density there. It's like Victoria. And this is just a few seconds before the Sendai earthquake struck. Now, what we're going to see is the real vertical and horizontal displacement once the earthquake hits. I'm going to animate this in a moment. So there's 1 metre. You can get some idea of how far 1 metre is, going vertically and horizontally. So let's fire this up and we can watch this. Okay. So the countdown has started. The island is moving a bit. The earthquake is about to strike. And that gives you some idea in real time of the power of a full network. Now, this is for seismic events. We were talking about precise positioning for, you know, ordinary location events, but you can see what else we can do with it. So it's still going. This is still real time. You can see the displacement post-earthquake. So Japan, and we're going to cycle through it again, Japan heads towards America by several metres. It drops in places and it rises in places. And you can see it rises in places by metres and moves by metres. And instantly we get some idea of the enormous dislocation that's occurred within Japan.
We were listening there to Peter Woodgate, the Chief Executive Officer of the Cooperative Research Centre for Spatial Information. Spatial, by the way, is S-P-A-T-I-A-L, not space as in the space show. And we'll return to that forum next week when we have a question and answer session. Now, just a reminder that you are listening to the Space Show.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.